Well, I tell you what, I retired from the railroad on October 19th, 1979, at the ripe old age of 27. And I like to think of it as a retirement. You know, it was really a layoff, but in my mind it felt more like a retirement. It was moving on. And the one thing that I took away from the railroad was this switch key. And so if you ever have a need, you know, for getting into a siding somewhere, I can help you with that. And somewhere is my railroad retirement, which I haven't quite located yet, but I'm getting more interested every day. I know that it's out there someplace. So the fortuitous part of this event, though, was that through a strange intersection of a hidden part of a labor agreement, an obviously bad recession. You know, by the way, unemployment at the time was running above 10%. Inflation was running above 13%. And the prime rate was at 20. So I don't know where that put mortgages, but it must have been around 25% a year, which is pretty startling when we look back now. No wonder I was scared, you know, because here I was now venturing into something new. But through the magic of this hidden agreement, I found out that I had a severance payment coming to me, which allowed me for the first time in 8 years to actually go to college full-time, because I worked for the railroad full-time and went to college part-time, and I was starting to become known as the tenure plan kid, who was no longer a kid, you know, I was actually becoming a young man. So the first time I got to go to college in Missoula, Montana, full-time, full tilt. This was my life. I got to the end of my 45 remaining credits in order to graduate with my bachelor's degree, and I still had money left. So I thought, this is too good to be true. I think I need to get myself one of those MBAs, because that's what everybody at the time was talking about. So I did, and it was only one more year I got the MBA. And then it was interesting. Something happened in January of 1981. So recruiting cycles were always kind of sparse, and especially at that period in time, there weren't a lot of recruiters around because, I mean, we're in the middle of a recession. Ronald Reagan was talking about supply-side economics, and everyone was confused. And so employers weren't necessarily wandering around looking for people at the time. And yet there was one guy that was coming to campus that was really interesting, a guy named Gary Atkins, and he worked for Hewlett-Packard in Boise, Idaho. I knew where Boise was, by the way. I had been through here before, and in a lot of respects, it reminded me of Libby, Montana. But let's just say I was really interested in working for Hewlett-Packard at the time, because all of the books, all the management books and everything were just filled with all these compliments about a tremendous culture and what a great company, and this is the way that you would do it if you did it yourself, if you were brilliant. And so I was so excited to get this interview, and I had the interview with Gary, and I felt that there was some magic, but then I talked myself out of that after I left the room as just being caught up in the moment. You know, there was no way that anything like this could happen. Gary got back to Boise, and he gave me a call, and he said, "We'd like you to come down to Boise and actually talk to us." I was so excited, you know. I couldn't wait to get on Northwest Airlines, you know, from Missoula, Montana, and fly to Seattle and get on Hughes Air West and ride the banana to Boise. You know, so and I did. I wound up here in February. They just finished having a beer bust the night before. Everybody was looking a little odd. But I tell you, ever notice how smells stick with you? Have you ever noticed, like, every once in a while you'll get a whiff of something? I'll tell you what, I walked into the building in Boise, and it was the anachronism of the railroad versus high tech, you know. So the railroad, everything smelled like oil. And if it didn't smell like oil, it meant that you were probably standing in it, right? Because you just couldn't sense it any longer. So it was either creosote or oil. Everything dripped oil. Everything, you know, you have oil all over you all the time. You go into Hewlett-Packard and it's just clean. And I thought, fresh paint. They just painted. And it's like, no, it isn't fresh paint. It took me a long time to put my finger on it. It was the same smell as our color TV right after it was turned on the first time. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's an electronic smell, like things are heating up, because I have never seen so many electronics in my whole life. I mean, you get up on a floor at HP without any walls, and they have tools, like somebody forgot there was a budget. And all these things are burning electricity, and the smell is just incredible. And that sticks with me to this day. If I were to walk through that site today, I'm sure I'd walk up the stairs and I would smell that smell, and it would take me right back to my very first day of being there. I just so wanted to go to work there. I would have done anything to get a job there. Unfortunately, I had to wait weeks after they'd put me through this horrible gauntlet of six people interrogating you. And I think they were measuring how much sweat, because they never gave you any water. You know, so if you fainted at the end of this, you weren't qualified. You know, if you made it through the entire gauntlet and people didn't find anything wrong with you, you might get a job. And so June 22nd, 1981, I went to work for Hewlett-Packard in Boise, Idaho. I was so excited. I got to Boise. I couldn't wait to go through the doors. And, you know, they make you feel like you're part of the team even when you're not there yet. I mean, they have your badge already made. They've got business cards for you. You have a phone. You have a desk. People call you by your first name, and you haven't even met them yet. You know, and it's that's the kind of environment that this place was. Right away, though, I realized that, you know, the kind of the tenor of the place and the way that people are talking, there's more to this story than meets the eye. And so after about a week of kind of trying to understand where the bathroom was and are the donuts really free, and I don't have to put any money in anything for coffee, you know, unlike the railroad, it's like I start to settle in a little bit, and they decide to tell me what my first assignment is. And so it's a very serious meeting. It's with my boss's boss and my boss. So we sit down at this table, and they said, well, we've decided what it is we want you to do. And it's like, great, my first project. And they said, no, this isn't a project. This is your first job. It's like, okay, all right, I'm ready, whatever it is. They said, we want you to increase sales of our products and do sales development for Canada and Europe. And I thought, I figured the railroad out. I can figure this out. So I said, okay, so who will train me how to do that? And my boss's boss looked incredulous. And I remember he put both palms of both hands on the table and he leaned forward toward me and he said, that's why we hired you. And I said, I'm starting to feel the pressure of the HP way. And it landed squarely on my shoulders. And it's like the responsibility, you know, that everybody feels at this place suddenly, just like that part of the story was filled in. It's like you are going to be responsible. You know, nobody is going to make it happen and hand you a paycheck. You're part of this team. You got to help make this go. So I did that. And thank God for some of the people in this room, because I ran into Russ Bouchard, who was trying to do the same thing from California, but he was selling little mini computers, and all my gizmos, my printers and tape drives and all these other things that I was supposed to be selling, connected onto all of his stuff. So he was good enough to hold me by the hand and say, this guy's okay, introduced me to all these salespeople, kind of got me on my road. But then the general manager of the place, a wonderful human being named Ray Smellick, who actually brought HP to Boise. The transparency of this company, by the way, is kind of scary. Because they get up and they tell you everything that you don't want to know. And Ray used to do this around coffee talk, and it was hazardous because you'd be holding a hot cup of coffee as he would tell you these things. And Ray would get up and he would stand at the microphone. Ray had kind of a funny voice, and every once in a while I used to be able to do his impression. But he'd stand up and he would say, well, things aren't very good this quarter. Our numbers are really down. Our expenses are really up. And if this keeps up, you're going to be looking at a new general manager up here. So he said, we've got to turn this around right away. And it's like, I don't know exactly how we're going to do this, but I know that we have a whole bunch of talented people. We're going to figure this out. And it's like, oh, God, I really hope so, Ray. And the way Ray always ended the coffee talk was, are there any questions? And it's like everybody would look around and he'd go, are there any answers? And that would be the end of the coffee talk. And so what I learned was I was so lucky to join HP, and I just happened to join a failing division of HP. And then there was this hubbub. We were going down the hall one day coming back from lunch. It was a meager lunch. And we got pulled into a room by one of the lab guys, you know, a guy named Roger Archibald. He says, come here. And so it's like, what? He goes, come here. So we all go walking into this little conference room off of the hallway. And he goes, can you keep a secret? It's like, well, yeah. He goes, look what I've got. And he shows us this little laser printer. It's about this big. Thing sells for about 60% less than anything on the market today. It's like, wow, that is really cool. And he goes, you want to see the coolest part? It prints envelopes, sticks envelopes in the back. The unfortunate thing, it sealed them. We'll work around that. But people were losing faith very quickly, like this peer group that had taught me, Dave Malin, Jim Skog, Scott Wald, Ed Pavlinik. These people are running for the doors. You know, they're looking for other divisions in HP to go to work for. Tom Old and a few others are not smart enough like me. We're just sitting around waiting for the harvester to come. I thought, well, I've done this on the railroad. I can survive this again. But this thing was going to be the key. This was going to be our risky business venture. And it wasn't going to lift my boat. It was going to lift everybody's boat. So this thing became known as the laser jet. But the interesting thing about it was we were sourcing parts, most of it, absolutely all of it, in fact, from a company called Canon in Japan. And so the Canon executives used to come to Boise, you know, which they actually loved this place after a while. Okay, after a long while. But they would come here and they would sit on one side of the table and the most senior person would sit in the middle of the table. And then they would spread out left and right, you know, according to post, if you will. We didn't do that. We were kind of messy. You know, we would leave a place in the middle for Ray, and then we would just kind of scatter around, right? And so we were arguing about how we were going to form up a contract to run this exchange of business. And they would argue a lot in Japanese amongst themselves. And at this one point, we're sitting in this conference room, and there were probably about six, seven of us on one side, and a pink slip came through the door and went down the table to Ray. And Ray looked at the pink slip. It was obviously somebody had called, but it was an important call. It was probably one of those jerks from Palo Alto wanting to know when is he going to get a profitable division. And he looks at this pink slip. He realizes these people are not going to shut up for a while, so he gets up and walks out of the room to return the call. As soon as he clears the door and the door shuts, the most senior guy just lets loose, Mr. Kitamura, just chews out everybody at the table. All of a sudden, the whole thing just goes silent, and we're just sitting there waiting for Ray to come back. Ray comes back in. He sits down at the table, and he goes, well, Mr. Kitamura says, Mr. Smellick, we have a deal. And he shakes his hand. That one handshake was worth somewhere north of about $160 billion. There never was a contract. It was always a handshake. Believe it or not, all that business transacted over 30 years without a contract, which is just kind of incredible in this day and age, especially between two cultures, the culture of Boise and the culture of Japan, you know. So it was an incredibly risky time, but in 1984, we launched the product. We sold $36 million of these things. That was pretty phenomenal. 1985, we're on a roll. We sold $190 million worth of those products. The PC is going like this. It's just a wild time. We're just really enjoying it, but we're extremely paranoid because we know how we started this thing. We started this thing from a very bad spot. We're probably all going to get fired because this is going to end as soon as IBM comes and squishes us just like that, like a bug. And we wait and wait and wait, and IBM doesn't come. And we think they're toying with us. Just to make it worse, they're just toying with us. Finally, 1991, I felt it was my shift because I was the marketing manager at the time, and I thought, how appropriate that they attack now on my watch so I can be the guy known as the one that screwed up this business and drove it right through the floor. The business, by the way, at that time, 1991, was just north of $2 billion a year. If we lay a trap, basically, with all these friends that we've made now out in the field, you know, and Russ is there, and Janet's there, and Jim Lyons is on board. All of us are kind of just collaborating all the time, trying to figure out how to avoid the inevitable. And we come up with this really clever idea. Let's pay everybody who sells a laser jet $100 for selling a laser jet from September through the end of October. because IBM's going to launch somewhere in that window. And we thought, you know, if nothing else, we'll go down with a big flare and we'll be popular. And I understand now, because it's been years and I've talked to people, because the dust has settled and, you know, bygones. And the IBM people have told me that they were shocked. This was the first time that they could ever remember in their history that they threw a party and nobody came, because everybody was so busy trying to collect those $100 bills that we were handing out that they wouldn't bother to go to the IBM training and the launch events and all of the rest. And from there, we never got over the acute paranoia. We were always, always, always paranoid that there was another boogeyman in the weeds someplace. And if we didn't believe it, then we would make one up. And the business grew and grew and grew. But here's the big reveal. Little known fact, but truly one that I really hold in my heart. The people that hide behind that berm out there actually saved the company of Hewlett-Packard. And Ray Smellick was the one that had the guts to do it to begin with. And had they not done that at that time, HP would have been in the same condition as Tandem Computer, DEC Computer, Data General, AMDAL, Prime Computer. The list goes on and on and on of companies that you've never heard of, right? And there's a reason, other than DEC, there's a reason you haven't heard of them, because they're long gone. And that was the business HP was in. And so what happened behind this berm over here was the fact that they were clever enough, they were paranoid enough, they worked hard enough, everybody collaborated and pulled together and looked at this as survival. And before we could spell entrepreneurship, we actually did that within a very, very large company. And as a result of that, we made enough money and cash, especially, that allowed the PC part of the business to figure out the right algorithm. It allowed the server part of the company to try to figure out how to recover having missed the internet boom. It allowed services to make a lot of mistakes and be unprofitable for years and finally sort that one out. It allowed us to survive the demise of the mass storage business here in Boise and absorb all those employees. Not even one was lost. And had that not happened, I can't actually say with any confidence that HP would even be anywhere around anymore. So at any rate, that's my story of risky business and the big payoff at the end. Thank you.